Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of April 2016. Welcome to episode 11 of our ongoing podcast concept to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which makes it pretty much the books I read during April. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly link to those on Facebook and Twitter so you can find them. Now, April had 5 Saturdays, so this includes the books that I read at the end of March also. But don't tell anybody that, okay? Those posts are not exactly spoilers for this podcast, since they're just lists, but here we'll have a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little bit of feedback on last month's episode. Clinton Robison of the Coffee and Comics blog was very excited about this episode. Hooray! This is the closest I have and may ever come to being semi-responsible for your homework books. I am inflating my ego with a bicycle pump as we speak. Another wonderful episode, Professor. As soon as I assemble a full run of Extreme Justice, I shall box it up and send it your way. For research purposes, and surely not for helping to stay warm on a cold winter's night. Well, thank you, Clinton. We could always use more kindling. Zeb Oswalt said it was a cool podcast, as always. Roy Thomas's Conan was a fun read. I've only read a handful of Doctor Who comics, mostly ones with the 4th and 6th, and a few of the 5th Doctor, in spite of the fact that Ace is my current screensaver. He also admits that he didn't read much of Underworld Unleashed. Gregor Rujo, David Ace Gutierrez, and Billy Hogan all concurred that Whiteout by Greg Rucka and Steve Lieber is an excellent read. Thanks, everybody, for the feedback. And now, on to the books I read last month. As we do on this show, I'm categorizing the books that I cover. And first are the issues I read specifically for podcast purposes, as Clinton said. I call these the homework books. Kingdom Come 1-4. This is the 20th anniversary of this event, and podcasting's Michael Bailey approached Emily and myself for a guest shot or crossover or something to cover this. And with the book's religious imagery and concepts and characters, we'll probably do our half on Darkness to Light. I don't know when, having to coordinate my schedule and Emily's and Michael's, but now that I've read it again, I can pass that trade along to Emily, so we'll be prepared whenever Michael comes a-callin'. Ms. Marvel, 6-19. This title has been on our short list for Darkness to Light really since we started that side project, because she is a character from a particular religious background. The idea of her growing up Muslim in the U.S. is an interesting take for us. And it's really, really good, too. Actually, I probably should have mentioned this first, because we'll probably cover this before Kingdom Come. What I like about this series, this current version of Ms. Marvel, is that it captures the essence, I think, of being a teen in the 2010s, from what I can tell. I remember what was important to Emily and her buddies, recent high school graduates. And I've asked students a number of young people just barely out of high school. And I just think that G. Willow Wilson really nailed the attitude, the worries, the concerns, the fangirling, the family drama really well. That's a highly recommended book. Cyber Rats, 1. Speaking of highly recommended, no, just kidding. This was a spinoff from Bloodlines, which we did for April Fools. This one was written by Chuck Dixon, and like the Bloodlines books I read from Mike Grell and Mark Wade, this one is absolutely the best you could expect, given that it's related to Bloodlines. But the worst part about reading this book was what happened when I went to lunch at Raising Cane's, a fast food joint specializing in chicken tenders and crinkle-cut fries. And yes, it is as good as it sounds. But anyway, I often take a comic book with me when I go out to lunch to help me pass the time, and hardly ever I mean, like, almost never does the cashier or server ask what I'm reading. But the day I have Cyber Rats in my hand, the cashier decides to be friendly and ask what I'm reading. All I could mumble in reply was, you know, it's an old one, it's like 20 years old, and it's not all that good. Oh, the shame, the shame, the shame. I do have an issue of Ms. Tree Quarterly lined up for a Quarterbin episode coming up, and if I can swing that, it might be a crossover with another podcast. And if that works out, it'll be two issues that I cover, the last two of that run, 9 and 10. And let me tell you how much I liked those, sort of a spoiler. And it's this. When I saw copies of Ms. Tree Quarterly 5 and 8 at the extremely outrageously high price of $1 each, I snapped them up. Now, don't go crazy. Remember that these issues do have more than 50 pages of story each, so they're still a pretty good deal. And I love the hard-boiled nature of this, which is that's the kind of story that Max Allan Collins writes best. In issue 5, there's a serial rapist murderer stalking a college campus, and Ms. Tree's stepson gets caught up in the investigation, but he wasn't the criminal. The actual criminal was... I can't tell you, it's a mystery book. In issue 8, 9 months have passed, because it's a quarterly book, and Ms. Tree is extremely preggers in this issue. So, she takes her maternity leave. When I eventually track down issue 6 and 7, I expect to meet the man who, as she says, did this to me. All I know is that by issue 8, he is dead. It certainly makes for a pretty interesting setup for the hard-boiled detective story. Not just a woman as the lead, but a pregnant woman as the hard-charging, tough-as-nails PI. In addition to a discussion on abortion and why she's keeping the child, she finds herself the target of attacks, and is, as she puts it herself, a very big target these days. But maybe it's not her that the enemy wants dead. What if it's the baby? And books I read for listening to podcasts. Just one, Legion of Superheroes number 70. This is for a podcast I just recently discovered a few months ago from Mark Sweeney. His blog and podcast are called I'm the Gun. And on the show, he covers Shanna the She-Devil and the reboot Legion of Superheroes. And I happened to see this one for cheap recently and knew that it was one of the ones he had recently covered, but in an episode I hadn't gotten to yet. So I bought it to follow along with him. And Emily has some Legion books in her collection, so I bought it, read it, listened to Mark, and sent it off to her. So it ended up in her collection after I listened to the episode. And then on to new comics that we read right off the shelves. These are all from DC, which means their clocks are ticking before they get rebirthed. We have three this month. And again, thank you, DC Comics, for putting all of these out on the same day. DC Bombshells 11, this one took place completely in England, the front of this version of the war. It's pretty much all the bombshells going up against demon hordes and Baroness Paula. Lots of fighting, and also a decent amount of kissing for what it's worth. Starfire 11, this one picks up with the after-battle celebration from last issue, and the three girls spend some quality time together in the under-the-sea spa. The sheriff confesses that as much as she appreciates Corey and her friendship, her presence has undoubtedly made their town and her life much more dangerous. And, by the way, she's not a fan of Corey dating her brother either. This is clearly paving the way for Corey to leave Key West, which is what I assume happens next issue, the final issue of the run. Constantine the Hellblazer 11, poor John, is totally out of place in the sun-soaked atmosphere of Los Angeles. But if you need to talk to an important angel, you go to the City of Angels. New York is a demonic mess, thanks to Neron. So Constantine's out west looking for help. And then the moment Emily and I wanted on the TV show, but it was gone too soon. Dead Man shows up to drag John back to New York to do his heroic duty. and he does not like this plan one bit. And on to just a regular reading that I did for April. The last trade of Ms. Marvel also included chunks of issues 7 and 8 of the current Amazing Spider-Man. And those were good as well because, again, I think that Ms. Marvel is sort of the current version of what Spidey was in the 1960s. The regular teen with some superpowers. So that team-up made perfect sense, and it gave us the opportunity to put what are, in essence, sort of two versions of the same type of character together. S.H.I.E.L.D. number 2, this is also in one of the Ms. Marvel trades, but she was a side character, so we won't be talking about it on Darkness to Light. It was a fun adventure story where Agent Simmons was sent into Kamala's high school as an undercover substitute teacher to investigate some of the crazy things happening there. And when crazy things do happen there, Ms. Marvel, of course, shows up, and they all work together to save the day, and Phil Coulson is very impressed with Ms. Marvel. Donald Duck, the Pixelated Parrot. This is another of the hardcover collections of Carl Barks' work on Walt Disney comics from the 40s to the 60s. Fantagraphics is publishing these. And the interesting part of their plan is that they have organized Barks' work into its proper chronological order, but they're not releasing the volumes in that order. They're releasing 2 per year, but the first 3 volumes they released were 7, then 12, then 11. At this point, I think they've released 5 through 14. So eventually, they will release the entire corpus of his work in chronological order, but they're not releasing those books in that order. It's an odd setup, but this one, by the way, is number 9, released in 2015. I think this is the 4th of these that I've read, and they are really impressive collections with modern coloring, but they've actually made no other changes for content, no other edits. The stories are generally very good, whether they're one-page, one-gag strips, or longer stories, and some of the stories crack 30 pages. And Barks' ability to keep the action moving while keeping it funny enough is a real skill. This is top-notch, high-quality stuff. Tom and Jerry, 242. This one's from 1968, and it was a pretty standard humor issue. I think that most of the Bugs Bunny and Disney books I've read from this general era have been a little bit better. Now, I'm not generally a huge Tom and Jerry fan, and maybe this one just didn't work as well in comic book form as these characters do in animation. Maybe that's what was going on. There was a double-sized 10-page story that was basically the back half of the issue, and that was my favorite. Maybe just giving it more room to breathe, more time to develop the gags is what worked to me. The 5-pagers that opened up the issue, just they were okay. Doc Savage Magazine, 6 through 8. I mentioned last month that I met up with Podcasting's Michael Bailey on his home turf of Atlanta. And in the exchange of comics that followed, he gave me the Doc Savage Showcase Presents, which are the mid-1970s issues of Doc Savage Magazine, actually published by Marvel. These were all a real treat. One long story per issue, about 50 pages, written by a young Doug Mensch. The stories take place in the 30s, and both the plot and the art just capture that feel. Issue 6 was about pyramid power and returned Egyptian god. And there was an evil zeppelin that had a ray beam that could put entire cities to sleep. Issue 7 sent the team to the Amazon, where we have huge super-evolved insects, as well as a pitch for the ancient alien astronaut theory of human development. This one had pencils by the great artist Val Merrick, which in the black and white of the showcase just looked great. The last issue, issue 8, had a super crazy scientist draining the brains of great scientists and thinkers around the world, meaning that, of course, he would eventually come after Doc and his crew. This one was a fun, globe-trotting romp of a story. These are all just fun adventure stories, and there's nothing wrong with fun adventure stories. And once I had Doc Savage on my brain, it didn't take me too long to actually notice for the first time a Doc Savage book in the cheap bins. So I picked up Doc Savage number one. This is from the 1987 four-issue mini, the first thing that DC did when they got the license. Now, this one differed from the magazine stories in that it started in the 1940s, and then as it goes on, the mini seems to move on into the future. That's what I can take from the future solicits. And that's a different take on Doc Savage, and I'd be interested to see where the series goes. It's Denny O'Neil writing with the art of the Kubert boys, so obviously there's a high level of skill, high level of professionalism, of technical quality that is present in this issue. Obviously, like I said, it's the beginning of a four-issue story, so it's sort of a grade of an incomplete at this point. All right, well, time to play a promo here, and when we come back, we'll talk about trades and minis and graphic novels.
Daddy, has Hulk always been green?
Well, no.
Daddy, has Spider-Man ever been married?
Well, that's quite complicated.
Daddy, did Superman have a mullet?
What? No, there's no
Daddy, does Howard the Duck use foul language?
Okay, stop. I must have done something wrong with your education somewhere along the line, but it's time to rectify that.
You mean...
Don't say it!
You're doing another podcast?
Oh no.
Podcast? Yes. Mark's Mess Podcast, an ongoing podcast to introduce and inform my children about the world of comics, science fiction, and general geekery. Join me each month along with my eldest daughter, Charlotte.
Where's my fiver?
And my youngest, Catherine.
Me!
As we explore all this together.
Find us at marksmesspodcast.blogspot.co.uk.
On Facebook at Mark's Mess Podcast.
And on Twitter at Mark's Mess Podcast without the T. A new podcast.
On a new feed.
Same old Mark.
And we're back. And last up, the trades and graphic novels and miniseries I read. I've mentioned the last number of episodes how much I enjoyed the Underworld Unleashed miniseries and most of the tie-ins that I'd managed to find. And guess what? I found a few more. And now I believe I can finally say, no more Underworld Unleashed tie-ins. I've read enough. Apocalypse.
Dark Uprising.
Sorry, it has to be said like that. Darkseid has disappeared from the land of Apocalypse, and Neron sees that power vacuum as an opportunity. He offers his deal to Granny Goodness, to Saad, Dr. Bedlam, and others. Some take the deal, some don't, but they all go to war with each other. And whoever wins, Neron wins, because they've increased the amount of evil in existence. Lobo, 22. I'm generally not a fan of Lobo, at least not after he developed into that which he was originally mocking. But here, the mockery is in full bloom, and the humor is right on target. Neron powers up one of Lobo's villains, and then he approaches Lobo himself, and Lobo actually tricks Neron. He outthinks him. And that, by itself, is pretty funny. REBELS 95, number 13. I've never read any REBELS before, and even though I do consider myself a fan of various runs of the Legion of Superheroes, I've never read any LEGION either. In this one, Liril Dox, described in the intro of the book as power-hungry, makes a deal with Neron. Things go bad, and I think there's a dramatic ending, but I really couldn't tell. Robin, number 24. We covered Robin 23 a month or two back, and in that one, a Neron-powered killer moth had left Robin in a cocoon. And this one, things don't go great for the Boy Wonder, and he has to call Batman for rescue. But a mysterious character scares the bad guy away, and actually is the one that saves Robin. There's dramatic stuff, and look, Chuck Dixon just knows how to write believable dialogue. On the last Quarter Bin episode, the one with Stella, I mentioned that there was a comic shop where the only thing I ever bought from them was quarter books, and that some new comic day I should just go to that store and spend some real money so I don't, you know, just hit their cheap bins. So I went to that store, World's Greatest Comics, and picked up the three number 11 issues that I talked about, what, about 10 minutes ago? And of course, I did hit their quarter bins, and for the first time, they had some Flashpoint books in there. I skipped Flashpoint because it was actually the new 52 that Emily and I used as jumping on point for buying new comics. In my case, after more than 15 years out of buying new comics. So we picked up after the Flashpoint event, just sort of let this happen without paying any attention to it. But for a quarter each, I thought some Flashpoint books might be worth the effort. The cheap box had some books from minis and some one-shots, so I ended up picking up four books. Flashpoint, Frankenstein and the Creatures of the Unknown, 1-3. Frankenstein, Agent of Shade, was a new 52 book that I really enjoyed. And this mini does really serve as the lead-in to that series. Both were written by Jeff Lemire, and he can really handle these oddball, on-the-fringe storylines really well. Wasn't sure what to expect with this one, not knowing what was going on in DC right here, right before the new 52. But this was solid. It was a good read. Flashpoint, Grodd of War, one shot. I picked this one up just because Grodd. It was sort of a slice of life story, almost a character piece focusing on Grodd. In the continuity of Flashpoint, I guess, Grodd controls all of Africa, but he's not satisfied. Not satisfied because he has no physical challenges. He has no political challenges. But he does what he must in this issue. He finds people to fight. Ultra Klutz, 10-14. I'm a big fan of the old Japanese TV show Ultraman, and I've even talked about some of his comic books with fellow Ultra fan Luke Giaconetti on his excellent Earth Destruction Directive podcast, part of the Two True Freaks Network. So I could not resist when I saw these recently. I did not know they existed. Ultra Klutz is a black and white book from 1987-ish that started life as a small press effort, which had just graduated to direct sales by the time these issues came around. It was created, written, and arted by Jeff Nicholson. The art and lettering are a little sub-professional, shall we say. But there are some fun moments, and a lot of the attempts at humor actually succeeded. Iowa's Joe Crawford sent me an interesting bunch of comics back a month or so, and this is the move of a true fan. Because back in the year-end episode, I talked not just about comics, but about comic-related books that I'd read over the year, and one of those was The League of Regrettable Superheroes, which detailed sillier, oddball, or bizarre comic book characters from over the years. And one of those that I mentioned in passing was Brain Boy. Well, in 2013, Dark Horse rebooted Brain Boy with a couple of miniseries written by Fred Van Lente. The premise is that Matt Price is the world's most powerful telepath, and he's about 20 years old, and he works as a subcontractor for the Secret Service. Now, good old Joe evidently remembered my brief mention of Brain Boy, because he sent me all of the Dark Horse Brain Boy. And last month, I read them all. We start with Brain Boy Zero, which are the character's first appearances in 50 years, which occurred in three parts of Dark Horse Presents, 23-25, but this single issue just collects those. Again, this specific issue was printed after the first three-issue mini, which confused me at first, but since they were reprints, they actually appeared individually before that mini, which made more sense. All I'm trying to say is I read this one first. And it was a good introduction. It was a tense, thriller-type story involving keeping the president safe at an international conference of world leaders. Actually, it's about protecting the football with the nuclear codes. In our world, this is a briefcase. But in Brain Boy's world, this football is a person. One of these enhanced superbrains whose thoughts can't be penetrated. Or can they? It's a tense story with some nice character moments from Matt. By the way, he hates being called Brain Boy. Brain Boy 1 through 3, and this one, Brain Boy, I mean Matt, faces down another highly powered telepath, a man who happens to be the strongman leader of a socialist country in South America, a man he is charged to protect as part of his job at an international conference. And we learn of different types of telepaths, different types of mental powers, including a woman who's immune to telepaths, who's invisible to them. Good stuff all the way around, really interesting world-building and character work, but all of that is in service to a pretty good action-adventure, political thriller story, broadly of the Tom Clancy variety. And Brain Boy, The Men from Gestalt 1 through 4. This one takes us a little further into Matt's relationship with the corporation that raised him. In terms of the plot, Brain Boy's new mission has him going up against a doomsday-style cult with a political agenda that attracts the attention of the Secret Service. This one had the entire Obama family as characters, and I'm not sure that I like that level of realism, quote-unquote, in my comics, but the story itself was pretty good. These were fun, fun comics. I was Joe Crawford. Good work. FYI, these came out about 2 years ago, and from what I can tell, Brain Boy has not been seen in print since. From Brain Boy, we go to Machine Man, 1 through 4. This is the 1984 miniseries, written by the legendary Tom DeFalco. These came to me from Canadian listener Rob Lance in his care package from a few months ago. Before reading these, my knowledge of Machine Man came almost exclusively from Indiana's Ben Avery. He covers a lot of the 1970s Marvel sci-fi on the comic book Time Machine feed, including the first series of Machine Man, which was a character that Jack Kirby created for his adaptation of 2001 A Space Odyssey. In this mini, we have jumped way into the future to the crazy wild sci-fi frontier of 2020. Machine Man has been reactivated by a group of cyberpunky scavengers known as the Midnight Wreckers. The team has to battle an evil industrialist. In comic books, is there ever any other kind? Evil industrialist Sunset Bane, as well as mercenary Arno Stark, the Iron Man of 2020. I'm a fan of sci-fi comic books, and I like this one. It took about half of the first issue to put myself in a late Bronze Age frame of mind. There are a lot of words in this book, and I generally don't mind that, but again, it just took a little getting used to. I had an impression, I don't know if this is sort of technically absolutely true, but it seemed that every single panel had either a speech balloon and or a caption box and or a sound effect. So it was a very throwback type of experience. It's a 30-year-old series. That's bound to happen. And yes, there were some silly terminologies and technology and all that, which you always get reading a far future book that ain't so far future anymore. But again, I mostly like this one. Shade the Changing Man 1 through 4. This is the Peter Milligan run, which was grandfathered into Vertigo a couple years later. I had the first 5 issues of the original Ditko issues from the late 70s. I probably picked them up in the mid-80s or so, probably at a comic show. Mostly, I remember that they were weird. And then he showed up again in the New 52 in the first few arcs of Justice League Dark, and again, very weird. But in between Ditko and the New 52, Milligan had written a Shade the Changing Man run for 70 issues. And somewhere along the way, I picked up these first 4 issues of it. And I know this is not a shock, but it's still really weird. A serial killer is executed, and at that moment, Shade takes over the body, even though he is still in the area of madness, wearing the M vest that allows him to alter reality. And he takes as sort of a sidekick one of the adult children of the serial killer's last victim, who was herself slightly crazy. And then they set out to stop the assassination of JFK. And that's when things get weird. And then, even more books from this episode's unofficial sponsor, Rob Lance, of the Comic Connection of Oakville, Ontario, Canada. This is Doctor Who, the 12th Doctor, and I read year one of this title, issues 1 through 16. This is the Peter Capaldi Doctor. And one thing that distinguishes this series from other Titan Doctor Who books that I've read so far is that this one features a companion from the TV show. In this case, he's traveling around with Clara. We start with a two-issue arc about terraforming gone awry, and we get to know an ominous people called Hyperius. Issues 2 through 5 send us into the 24th century, where an evil family is dedicated to reviving their ancient goddess. There's a cool character from the 1820s who gets involved too, a warrior woman named Marani. Mystical swords and magical aliens appear at the end, and the Capaldi Doctor is able to defeat the giant four-armed blue goddess. This was a pretty nice standalone arc. And if any reader wasn't sure that issue 5 ended an arc, the cover in issue 6 included a banner across the top that reads, "New storyline begins this issue." And you know what? I like that. The next three issues have only a brief mention of Hyperius and tell a pretty cool story about beings who police the multiverse. A human jumps from one dimension to another to reunite with his family who died on his world in an accident. But in this world, only the father died. But these good intentions of reunification of the family bring the fractures to our world to set the various dimensions aright. Issues 9 and 10 have something to do with an old Gallifreyan artifact, the Time Gun, but mostly it's a chance to put the Doctor and Clara in 1960s Las Vegas, hanging out with the Rat Pack. It was the perfect setting to put Capaldi into. He looked great, Clara looked great, and the setting just fit. A little two-issue arc that was delightful. And then we get a one-off story where the Doctor and Clara inspire Charlotte Bronte. Because British. And then they arrive in the present time, and the Hyperians have attacked, and are working pretty hard on destroying Earth. Along with Kate Stewart and UNIT, the Doctor and Clara manage to turn back the Hyperion invasion. And then we get issue 16, which, like the TV show, was the holiday special. Crazy thing is going on with the Christmas presents and toys, and of course, it's a very old-timey foe of the Doctor, the Celestial Toymaker. And it was a pretty good story. So now I've read the first years of Titan Comics of the 10th, 11th, and 12th Doctors, thanks to Rob Lance and the Comic Connection of Oakville, Ontario, Canada, that is. And I think this series may be the best. There's a good capturing of the relationship between the Capaldi Doc and Clara with a lot of nice quipping and back and forthing. And I think that's everything I read. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, look, Kingdom Come is pretty great, no surprise. Ms. Marvel is consistently excellent. Carl Barks' Donald Duck collection had some great stories. Brain Boy was a lot of fun. But in terms of single issues, Ms. Marvel meeting Captain Marvel was pretty great. But I still think I'm going to go with Doctor Who, the 12th Doctor, number 9, as the favorite single issue that I read this month. This is when the Doc and Clara roll into Las Vegas. Well, feel free to let me know what you think about this episode, what you think of any of these books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. Looking at the to-be-read pile, I expect the next episode to feature some Man-Bat goodness, some more Neron, I have the miniseries Rain in Hell, the New Universe graphic novel The Draft, and if the rumors are to be believed, maybe some comics sent on by a listener or two. And I'm looking forward to reading all of it and talking about it here. That episode should be out in early June. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.